It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Venezuela is in the midst of a humanitarian catastrophe. But right now, there's also a discussion in financial capitals about what happens to its $150 billion of debt. Venezuela and its state-owned oil company owe money not only to institutional investors, but also to corporations, and China, and Russia. Creditors have banded into groups, and some hedge funds have even filed lawsuits. In financial markets, things are already happening. This is Alpha Chat, a project from the Financial Times and the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. I'm Colby Smith, and I write for Alphaville. On the sidelines of the IMF spring meetings in Washington, D.C., Brendan Greeley and I sat down with Odette Linau. Odette is a professor of law at Cornell University and a visiting professor at Yale, and she wrote a book called Restructuring Sovereign Debt. We talked about Mozambique and Argentina and how vulture funds can do some good. We started with something I keep hearing in interviews. Venezuela's debt restructuring will be one of the most complicated in history. Here's Odette.
There are a couple things. So one is the political situation. I mean, for one reason, at least as of now, no one knows who they're actually supposed to be negotiating with, right? I mean, that's true of the creditors, and they seem to be, in some cases, trying to negotiate with both sides. That's true of major kind of bilateral, countries like the U.S., the EU, true of the IMF, who's currently sort of not talking to anyone because they also are not sure who they're supposed to be talking to. So there's the political element that's incredibly complicated. I mean, at the sort of high level, not to even mention the incredibly sad and depressing political element on the ground. And then there's the sort of the structure of the creditors themselves, right? So this is not a situation in which it's all bondholder debt, right? I mean, we have bondholder debt, and that's true for the Republic itself, for Venezuela, and also for PDVSA, the Venezuelan oil company, which has a huge amount of debt. And these are two separate sets of obligations legally, though people sort of think of them as together. But then you have just sort of commercial creditors, not bondholders, just sort of regular commercial creditors. And then we have, of course, the bilateral creditors themselves. These countries that have lent to Venezuela, especially when it became difficult for Venezuela to actually borrow on the capital markets. And so these, we know, include Russia and China, but we actually don't really know what is in those loan contracts and haven't been told. So we don't exactly know how much is in there. We don't know if these are collateralized, if in the event that Venezuela doesn't pay, if they have some claim on assets. Now, we suspect that at least some of them will be. We don't know what additional enforcement mechanisms might be in there. And so that's a difficulty, especially because in standard sovereign debt restructurings, you have a group of creditors that are in some ways accustomed to working with each other, right? So the Paris Club creditors, the EU, the US, the OECD, Russia is also in the Paris Club. China, which we believe has a lot of debt in Venezuela, is not a member of the Paris Club. And so it's kind of a range of difficulties.
So if we take a sort of a recent sovereign debt restructuring that people might be familiar with, Ireland, it's relatively simple. Several Irish banks failed. The Irish state underwrote the banks, and then the Irish state needed a bailout. It sounds almost comically simple, and yet it took several months to work out, even within the structures of the IMF and the European Union. And so now you're looking at a country where you've got three axes of complexity. You've got, you're not sure who it is that you're negotiating with as a creditor. There are a number of different creditors, and there are also a number of different ways that money was lent as a sovereign bond, as a bond to the oil company that's owned by the state, as a bilateral loan. So it's sort of hopelessly more complex than a non-trivial problem like Ireland.
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to just be a mess is sort of what people are anticipating now. I mean, we can hopefully make it less of a mess, but I mean, it depends on a whole bunch of people kind of getting together and agreeing in ways that this particular constellation of creditors have not really done previously. And of course, I mean, there's the additional question of the holdout creditors, which were less present in Ireland, but have been present in other restructurings.
On that point, I mean, we talk a lot about Argentina as some kind of parallel to Venezuela. And I think what's been really interesting about listening to people that were involved in that situation was how quickly it, you know, devolved into an unworkable situation when you had the holdout creditors, the vulture funds coming in and snapping up debt to then litigate to its fullest extent. Is there a risk that we could see holdout creditors again here in Venezuela? And if so, what lessons can we learn from the Argentina situation?
There's a massive risk, and in some ways it's actually potentially more intense, in part because I think some range of creditors have learned from the vulture fund strategy in Argentina, right? So
And what was that strategy? If you could kind of take us through step by step.
Sure, of course. So the standard approach, right, at least for bondholder creditors, is a country ends up in distress. And so then they'll say, okay, well, we're in distress. And ideally, they go and actually talk to their creditors and come up with some kind of consensual arrangement. In the Argentina case, they actually didn't end up doing that. They did a unilateral exchange offer where basically they said, look, give us your old bonds that we're not paying anyway, and we're going to give you new bonds that are going to basically pay at a discount, right? And so there are a range of creditors that did not like that, but ultimately they participated in that restructuring. There were some creditors, though, that decided not to do that. And these particular creditors are vulture funds, you know. So they're sort of a subclass of the distressed debt investor. So distressed debt investors purchase the bonds on the secondary market. So they're not the original lenders, but they're buying from the original lenders. And then sort of the standard distressed debt investor, they'll participate in the collective restructuring to sort of maximize their return. So the vulture funds are kind of a subclass within that. And so they're purchasing at a deep discount on the secondary market. But then instead of participating in the restructuring, they'll say, you know, forget all you people, you know, suckers participating in the restructuring. That's not for us, right? We're going to separately litigate and try to get significantly more money than everyone else. So in some ways, they're kind of leeching off the system because the availability of funds depends on everyone else restructuring, and then they decide to hold out, right? And so these additional creditors have seen the success that those funds had in Argentina, and you can imagine that they're going to be incentivized to do that more in Venezuela.
Do you think that's a motivation for why we've seen, I think it's some 6 or 7 lawsuits now from various hedge funds hoping to, you know, attain a judgment in hopes that that will give them leverage once regime change and restructuring actually occurs?
Sure. I'm sure that's got to be a factor, right? I mean, I can't remember exactly what the profit was from NML, which was the primary vulture fund involved in the Argentina litigation, but it really
got
was
$2 billion.
$2 billion, but there were some estimates of how much they'd actually invested, and I can't remember what that proportion was. But it was significant. I mean, so you can imagine if you're interested in that kind of thing, you want to do this. And in some ways, it's actually potentially easier for these vulture funds than in the Argentina case, because in the Argentina case, they didn't have as many assets in the U.S. And a lot of the Venezuelan oil is exported to the U.S., right? And so it's running around on oil tankers, right, all over the high seas, not to mention that Citgo, right, this gas station that probably all of you, and certainly I have gone and filled up my gas tank, is sort of owned through a range of companies by PDVSA, by the oil company. So there are assets in the U.S. much more easily available for recovery than, for example, the naval ship that they tried to go after in the Argentina case, which is a little like out there, you know.
And we've seen proposals from certain lawyers or advisors and other professors even as to how to deal with this asset seizure problem. And one that's gained some attention has been this executive order. So in similar situation with the Iraq case, where you had the UN Security Council ring fencing Iraqi assets so that creditors couldn't seize them, there's been, you know, a suggestion that the U.S. government could kind of issue some executive order in the same vein. Do you think that that is an effective, you know, solution to deal with assets? And is there a risk that, you know, by imposing this top-down restriction on creditors, that the ability for Venezuela to then again return to capital markets is compromised?
So, no, I don't think that that's likely to happen. So if something like this were to happen, which is not, I think, a sure thing, and my understanding is that, you know, there's uncertainty about this in the administration to the extent that they're thinking about this. But that shouldn't be a problem, because remember, the whole point is to impose this, basically render the Venezuelan assets immune from attachment. So you could get your judgment, but you couldn't actually then claim it. But the whole point is basically to make that strategy unavailable to vulture funds with the intention of protecting all of the other creditors, right? And so remember, all of the other creditors are generally going to be the creditors that are interested in the markets in the future, right? So so in some ways it is, it's sort of, in my view, a kind of less than ideal situation, if given the absence of a, something like a sovereign bankruptcy regime, to try to put a stay on this kind of creditor litigation with the intention of actually helping the consensual restructuring, which in the long run actually should enhance Venezuela's capacity to get back on the markets.
One of the ways in which international finance has changed, even over the last 5 years, is the arrival of Chinese investment money, bilateral loans from China, also from Russia, taking over some of the traditional functions of the IMF and the World Bank. You said something interesting, which is earlier today, which is that there are going to be some inexperienced creditors when we try to sort this mess out. Are they going to be incented to cooperate politically? Do they have enough of a stake that they're going to be incented to be? Is this going to be even more difficult politically than it is financially?
It could be. Maybe inexperience is not quite the right word. They have a lot of experience in doing this. But in this particular kind of restructuring, they haven't been as involved, especially as a major player, which we think, though honestly we don't really know, they could be in this situation. But I think the political dimension is important, and I'm worried about how things have been going on the political front a little bit, precisely because of this reason, right? To the extent that in any future setting, regardless of how it looks politically, you're going to need the involvement of the Chinese government and also the Russian government. If we're moving in a political direction in which we're alienating them and disrespecting their allies within Venezuela, that could make an eventual restructuring that much more difficult. Now, we don't know exactly how that works, but it's a situation that would take some diplomacy and some delicacy. And frankly, I'm not feeling very confident on that front, looking at our current governmental authorities in the U.S.
So when the the diplomatic tensions or the diplomatic dynamics meet with the legal ones, has there ever been situations where the diplomatic side kind of trumps the legal side? So, for instance, with some of these hedge funds that have gone out and gotten lawsuits or have gotten judgments, is there this chance that because the U.S. government seems to have so much on the line here in Venezuela, it has gone out and it's backed the opposition government, it is explicitly said that it's behind this regime change. Is there a chance that the legal end of that becomes of secondary importance then to the political side?
Sure. I think you don't want to say it's an either or, but I think you definitely want to think about the legal as embedded within the political, and also the political as potentially shaping what's happening in the legal. So I think that's true. There are circumstances, and you mentioned the Iraq case, and I think that's a good example, where notwithstanding the underlying legal situation, the existence of these contracts, and in that case, the fact that no one had agreed that a regime change, even from a dictatorial to, I don't know if we could say democratic-ish mm-hmm. regime, should make a difference, the fact that the U.S. government was so deeply involved, and maybe is an understatement of their involvement in Iraq, and was bringing in all of their allies, definitely impacted the restructuring and the outcome.
In the past, there's always been an argument with every restructuring whether the country is illiquid or insolvent.
Right.
The country says we're just illiquid, and it becomes pretty clear that they're insolvent. It seems like with Venezuela, we're dealing with a third case, which is that the state is neither illiquid nor insolvent. It's mm-hmm. failed,
right.
which is an order of complexity beyond either of those. Is that the right distinction to draw? And what's a precedent for any restructuring of a failed state?
That's a very good question. I think how exactly do you value the assets like oil in the ground, especially because it's actually kind of difficult and expensive to get out. People think that Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, but it's not, just sitting up there, easy to get. And so on that basis, there are a range of creditors that are still, you know, counting on the eventual oil coming out. But I think you're right that it kind of falls in between. And I think ultimately it is a failed state situation. And I mean, it's just a massive humanitarian crisis. And regardless of whether we eventually want to talk about liquidity or solvency in a country case, we have to first rebuild the institutions of the country or allow the country to rebuild its own institutions to then figure out, well, how actually do you access the assets that would kind of speak to that question in a way?
Yeah. So in a way, it's hard to compare to Argentina because Argentina was and remains a state, a functioning state.
For sure. Right. The default, the 2001 default resulted from sort of massive political and economic crisis and sort of an incredibly serious depression, but not the kind of constitutional crisis that we're seeing in Venezuela right now, which is incredibly difficult, certainly for the Venezuelans and also for people looking in and thinking about what actually is the best way to, you know, support Venezuela economically and also to support the self-determination of Venezuela's people to the extent that you're concerned about, because it's not entirely clear exactly what that would mean, regardless of what both sides are claiming.
The notion of Venezuela as a failed state brings to mind the concept of odious debts. So debts that are seen as illegitimate because they were incurred by a fallen regime without authorization or for purposes that didn't benefit the people. Mm-hmm. Odious debts as a legal concept hasn't ever really been tested. So could you make the case for their relevance in Venezuela?
I would be worried about thinking of something like regime change in quite the same way as we've seen these massive regime changes in other situations, right? I mean, a clear instance of something like regime change would be something like Iraq or, one of the historical examples of an idea like odious debt would be like the Soviet repudiation of Tsarist debt, right? And so this seems to me kind of an intermediate case where it's not a massive regime change in quite the same way. It's certainly a constitutional crisis. And as part of the constitutional crisis, there's potentially arguments that some range of the debt was incurred potentially in violation of the underlying laws, right? And so that's kind of akin to ideas of odious debt, but not going quite all the way. But, you know, as you point out, it hasn't in general been accepted as a doctrine in international law. That's not to say that it has no power, I think. I mean, I think to the extent that you have people, civil society groups external to the country, also internal to the country, pointing out the deep irregularities of a debt or highlighting how the debt did not really benefit the underlying population, then it seems to me like that could at least shape both what creditors are maybe willing to restructure, right? Or the types of arguments that are made, certainly in a Paris Club type context, maybe in a commercial creditor context. And also potentially, I think it could impact the degree to which a haircut, right, a cutting down of the debt actually has a reputational consequence in the capital markets, right? Because you could imagine that, okay, well, we got a 50% haircut, but actually the circumstances, even if no one wanted to say it straight up, are such that it's kind of reasonable and we shouldn't necessarily assume that this reflects on what the country would be willing to do in the future.
The argument would be we, the Venezuelans, didn't give you a haircut. Chavez Maduro gave you a haircut.
Something along those lines, right? And so even if it doesn't track specifically onto the legal doctrine, if that set of arguments were made and they were compelling, right, to the creditors listening to them, then you can imagine, and it's hard to sort of figure out exactly what the baseline is here, that in the event that Venezuela does return to the markets and is trying to issue bonds, that they end up potentially getting a better deal than they would in the absence of this type of argument.
But to make that case, you're essentially making a political argument in order to lower your cost of debt, because what you're saying is every element of the political ideology of Chavez and Maduro has been repudiated. It's not there anymore. We've built a new society. And therefore, you're not looking at those risks. You're looking at the risks of a completely different country.
So that's why that would be the classic odious debt argument, right? And why I think I'm not 100% sure it applies quite as clearly. But yeah, but it would be something along those lines.
So you wrote a paper.
I'm writing a paper.
You're writing a paper. we have looked at a draft of a paper about the utility of vulture funds, which is an argument that neither of us had heard before, that, we call them vultures. They certainly don't call themselves vulture funds. But like actual literal vultures, your point is they play a valuable role in the ecosystem of debt restructuring. Help us understand that.
Yeah, or at least they can. And I'm not the only one that's saying this, but I'm kind of interested in the paper that you're referring to. I'm looking at this kind of subset of vulture fund litigation that hasn't really been discussed very much, which is vulture funds. One of the things they're trying to do, right, when they're collecting on their debt, is they're trying to figure out, okay, where are the assets of the sovereign state, wherever they are, whether it's a ship or a launch contract with SpaceX or whatever, right? I'm going to try to get it. And so one of the assets that they've tried to identify and characterize as sovereign assets are assets that have been claimed as personal or private assets by the officials of the countries themselves, right? And it could be to sort of hide the assets away so creditors can't collect them. But potentially as part of that, and sometimes even more explicitly, they're just taking the money for themselves, right? And so they're sovereign assets that through exercise of corruption, basically, have become, sequestered and illegitimately privatized, right? And so in general, people are not looking at this, but the vulture funds in a couple cases have figured out through kind of impressive detective work, actually, sometimes also just reading journalism very closely in the countries themselves, right? So it's been uncovered by journalists saying, wait a second, these accounts are generally shell corporations, because that's how a lot of this hidden wealth is hidden these days. These shell corporations that you are claiming are private entities that have nothing to do with the state, in fact, are just vehicles for siphoning away the assets of the state. And so as part of this, they're trying to take this money back for themselves, right? So they're still trying to basically enrich themselves, but they have this positive externality, this benefit, right, of exposing corruption that otherwise is going, is hidden. And, you know, there are a range of efforts, global efforts, and I'm thinking of something like the World Bank Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative, that try to do something like this, that are doing kind of asset recovery and ideally sending the money back to the states themselves. But sometimes they haven't been as successful, in part because they require the cooperation of the state that's recovering the assets. And frankly, sometimes the ruling elites are all interconnected. So even if you've had a change in administration, they're still a little wary of, well, maybe we don't want to go all the way down that route. The vulture funds don't have that conflict of interest, so to speak. And so they have this sort of pure interest in finding the money and therefore uncover corruption.
They perform a role a little bit like short sellers in stock markets, which they also do not have the purest of interest, right? They have an incentive to make sure that the company looks bad and that things are uncovered. But that also often causes them or drives them to uncover very interesting and unsavory things about companies.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, I think the trick is then to see if there are other ways in which this could be done that don't strengthen the vulture funds themselves, right? I mean, that's because, I mean, one thing that you could say, and, you know, this is something that actually has been said, I don't know how seriously, by people just looking at the asset recovery side and frustrated with the lack of success in the global asset recovery regime. Well, maybe we should just do something like a private attorney general type thing, or where you basically deputize a private actor to try to do something that is arguably a public function. And the problem with that is that it's building a proposal on the asset recovery side, which is not a bad proposal, arguably, on a really problematic sovereign debt restructuring foundation, right? And so building that proposal on one side is arguably to strengthen the set of restructuring problems that we're trying to deal with on the sovereign debt side. So you kind of have to, I think, look at both sides simultaneously, right? The two sides of the transnational flows of capital.
Do you see the structure that we're talking about where you've got assets of the state and then you've got assets of people who have declared themselves to be the state? Do you see going after the assets of the Maduro family being a part of this restructuring that we're talking about with Venezuela?
Sure. I mean, to the extent that you have holdouts incredibly active, right, I would certainly think that some of them are going to take the playbook that they've taken in a couple other cases. And I'm thinking here of Congo-Brazzaville and also of Argentina, which is sort of a less discussed aspect of the many, many pages of Argentina litigation. So taking this playbook of trying to go after these ostensibly personal but actually public assets, and, you know, translating that potentially into the Venezuela context, right? To the extent that there has been a lot of corruption, which everyone seems to agree there has been, this could be another place where they're going to look for assets.
So in your most recent paper, you discuss the notion that we're in this heyday of vulture funds.
Yeah.
And, you know, the larger problem here is the fact that there isn't really a standardized process to kind of handle sovereign bankruptcies. So in this scenario where we can see, you know, value perhaps of vulture funds, do you think that's kind of delaying the process to come up with a more credible and standardized process to deal with restructurings going forward?
I don't think that the possible benefit from vulture funds is delayed. I mean, there are a range of reasons that people are not going after a sovereign bankruptcy regime. I'm hoping that that eventually changes, if not a full-fledged, you know, all the bells and whistles sovereign bankruptcy regime, some kind of, you know, effort heading in that direction to put in place, for example, a global stop to this kind of holdout creditor litigation, right? You could do kind of certain sub-mechanisms along those lines. But yeah, I mean, I think that ideally you want to move in that direction in part to deal with the vulture fund litigation. Now, it's not that frequent, though it seems, I mean, looking at the Venezuela situation, maybe it will start becoming more frequent given the success of the Argentina example. But even if it's not that frequent, I think it's a problem because when it happens, it can severely delay the success of the restructuring. It can disincentivize other creditors from participating in restructuring. And then even once you've actually had a restructuring go through, to the extent that you have ongoing vulture fund litigation and debts outstanding and unpaid, you can hinder the return of the country to capital markets and the growth of the country itself. I mean, that's part of what we see in the Argentina situation, where they actually had a restructuring go through that the vast majority of creditors agreed to, but this ongoing litigation meant that they still were stuck in this limbo.
So what's preventing us from moving in this direction to a more established regime to handle restructuring?
Well, it's just an incredibly politically difficult thing. So probably the best known effort thus far was the IMF's effort in 2002-2003 to set up a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism. And this was in part in response to an earlier set of successes in vulture fund litigation. And they said, wait a second, this holdout problem could be a serious issue, which they were right about. And UNCTAD, actually, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, a couple years before that had also identified this problem and proposed something. But they ended up not getting the support they needed, and that was for a couple reasons. Well, the primary reason was that the U.S. Treasury, which initially seemed like maybe they were going to be into it, decided that they weren't. The European countries, there were some that were more supportive, some that were less supportive. Among the borrower countries themselves, there was also a split, right? Because there were some borrower countries that said this would actually be incredibly helpful for us. There was another range of borrower countries that sort of basically it seemed decided that they could do without. They were concerned about a potential increase in borrowing costs. And also some of those borrower countries,
they were concerned that borrowing costs would actually reflect the risk.
Yes, exactly. The risk of a sovereign bankruptcy, which is, you know, which is fine. But on the other hand, I mean, we have a bankruptcy regime in the domestic context that doesn't seem to have actually raised borrowing costs that significantly. I mean, this is always the argument against bankruptcy. It's like, well, you can't have a bankruptcy regime because it's going to massively increase borrowing costs, and doesn't ever really seem to happen.
Well, I mean, the background to this, which seems to be driving incentives for a bunch of different actors, is that there is a flood of capital available in the world looking for a return.
Right.
So it is impossible to discourage people from buying sovereign debt or making these bilateral sovereign loans because everybody's looking for some kind of a return. And the returns from Venezuela are a little more exciting than they are in U.S. treasuries right now. So that in a way, there's very little that you can do to encourage anyone to come up with a more coherent process.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe you'd say there's so much lending to the extent that a sovereign bankruptcy regime would cool it down a little. Maybe that would actually be another good thing. Right. I mean, but no, I think it's true that people feel mixed about it, continue to feel mixed about it. There are additional calls for it. But I mean, you know, back in the day in the 2002-2003, some countries were into it. Other countries decided worried about borrowing costs. And honestly, they also decided they were economically, systemically important enough that if things really started to fall apart, someone's going to come to the rescue for them. And they're probably not wrong. I mean, thinking of like a country like Mexico coming off of the massive kind of U.S. Treasury-backed intervention assistance in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, right, when they were having, you know, a crisis. And they were right that, you know, the U.S. decided they were systemically important enough that they were going to organize something that ended up basically helping them out.
So this is familiar to all of us from the financial crisis in the U.S., which is that, and even the aftermath, the attempt to prevent another financial crisis, it became clear that large banks were not willing to come up with an actual insurance into which they'd pay a premium to handle this in the future, because why bother? Because they knew that they were too big to not be rescued. And in the same way, there are countries that know that they're too big to not be rescued.
Very similar dynamic.
We've been talking a lot about Venezuela, but in a way it seems unique because Nicolas Maduro is uniquely bad. But sovereign restructurings do come in waves. What will cause the next wave?
Well, you know, it's hard to predict, right? I mean, the IMF, I think, was it yesterday, just basically downgraded their economic growth forecasts to the lowest rates that we've seen since the financial crisis, right? So that's a kind of broad global thing that's happening. You know, I think after 2008, you have a series of mergers and acquisitions at a global level that to some degree is integrating financial institutions in a way that maybe is going to increase systemic risk going forward. You have a little bit of the softening or rollback of certain financial regulations that were put in place, and that could have an impact. I think that one of the things that we want to pay attention to is the increased risk that's brought about by natural disasters, which seem to be happening with greater frequency, and the general dislocation that might be resulting sort of in coming decades from climate change, right? I mean, I think that that is incredibly difficult and risk exacerbating factor.
And I think with risk culture in finance, people tend to think in terms of cycles because they've all lived through a couple of cycles or they've read about a couple of cycles. And what scares me about that risk is that it is just brand spanking new and that nobody in finance has any understanding of it. Very few companies outside of reinsurers who are going to have to bear these costs are willing to even admit that it's happening. And so there's just no protections around it, no thought about it. And when it really starts happening, you could argue that it already has. It's going to be a surprise in a way that it shouldn't because it's a new non-cyclical risk.
Exactly. I think that's absolutely right. It's highly predictable as a general global matter, but for any individual country trying to think about its risk profile and how to manage it going forward, it can be difficult to actually determine what's, I mean, there are ways you can potentially mitigate that, right? Sort of building into loan contracts, things like contingency clauses, right? Where repayment is pegged to commodity prices, right? Major export commodity prices or pegged to GDP. And you can build in contingency clauses, including sort of natural disaster contingency clauses where there's an automatic stay on litigation and, you know, something like that, but doesn't trigger across. You can draft them in various ways, but that doesn't deal with the fact that this is still out there and is going to impact both the capacity to make any debt payments and also massively potentially increase the need for financing and assistance.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like terrorism insurance in that for a long time, it was completely free. It was just thrown into the contract. And then suddenly one day it wasn't free anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
What is the country that you see most exposed to this combination of financial instability and natural catastrophe risk?
Most exposed? I don't think I can do that one. The combination.
If we think about Mozambique, I mean, they have a very uniquely difficult kind of debt restructuring process.
Sure.
And then when the cyclone hit, it just made everything exponentially worse.
Oh, for sure. I thought you were projecting forward. I was like, I don't know if I can go forward. But yes, for sure, Mozambique, right? I mean, right, absolutely. The sort of financial difficulties that they've been in part because of these loans that, you know, thinking about odious or illegitimate loans, that's a poster child for it. And then, of course, this cyclone Ida, right?
I mean, Puerto Rico is another example. It's not sovereign debt. It's municipal debt.
Absolutely.
But it's the exact same dynamic where they were already in a precarious situation and then all of a sudden they're devastated.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, those two examples, right?
So beyond this, climate change risk that we're talking about and the holdout creditors, it seems as though debt restructurings are set to get a lot more complicated going forward.
I think they could be. I mean, it's possible that, you know, we start by talking about Venezuela, and because of the incredible resource riches of Venezuela, there is a lot of creditor interest in a lot of different types of contracts, maybe more so than in some other locations. But I think it's possible that that is a model for things that we might be seeing in the future. But it's kind of hard to know exactly and to do that mapping, I think, really well.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah,
it was fun.
Thank you.
Alpha Chat is produced by Dan Richards at the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance and Amy Keene from the Financial Times. Please email alphachat@ft.com for any reason at all. For my part, I'm going to pay more attention to climate change and the impact on sovereign debt.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here at Bellingcat, we get to the bottom of things. From a global crisis to an underreported event, we find the facts using publicly available tools and resources, uncovering what is hidden on and below the surface. We connect the dots using social media posts, satellite images, and public records, and empower others to do the same by sharing how we do it. The ability to do so is only made possible by our readers, supporters, and community members. Care to join us? Learn how at bellingcat.com.